Welcome to The Magnificast, a podcast about Christianity and leftist politics. I'm your co-host, Matt Bernico.
And I'm back as your co-host, Dean Deloff.
Thank God, you're no longer the interviewee. You're back hosting the show, co-hosting it with me. So great to have you back.
I'm out from under Matt's big interrogating lamp, where he's both the good cop and the bad cop, and it feels better to be on the side. I'm sorry for calling you a cop, Matt. I said it, and I immediately regretted it. I couldn't think of a better analogy, but it's great to be back as a host with you. That's all I'm trying to say.
That's okay. As soon as you said big interrogating lamp, that's all I could think of was being the good cop or a bad cop. I mean, who else is out there interrogating people, you know? Nobody, so just cops. Who else could it be?
That's true. Journalists, I don't know. They don't get to have a cool lamp, though.
A complete non sequitur, moving on from what you just said. It's an election year, folks. It's 2024, the year of our Lord. And if you'll recall, if you're a real Magnificast head, a real OG podcast listener, you might remember that in, 2019, we probably had an episode like this where we decided that we were going to talk about voting and Joe Biden and what you should do about it and how you should feel about it. The worst part of election years is that everyone has to say what they think about voting out loud on the internet or to your face. They got to get out there. They tell you it's the most important thing. You got to protect the democracy that you live in. You've got to exercise your democratic muscles. And man, it's a lot to deal with, I think, every 4 years. And for me, you too, Dean, I guess, living in the UK, living in Scotland, and also it's an election year here, so I have to hear it twice as much in these two different contexts, and that's a lot. That's a lot to hear it.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to hear what you think for your first election year outside the country. We can finally compare notes. We're now two U.S. citizens with a podcast that often, I guess, is critical of U.S. politics, but neither of us live in that country anymore. So we'll see what the vibe is like this election year. But in my experience, it's also really weird to be a U.S. citizen during a U.S. election year in a different country, because also everyone feels compelled to express their opinion to you and also seek your expert opinion on what's happening in your extremely weird country of origin. So
yeah,
get ready.
That's right.
You're going to get a lot of great questions.
You know, like right when I moved here, we had a few people that did ask us what we think about Donald Trump. And it's just like, I don't know, man, that guy's insane. That's all I can tell you about him. He's nuts. He's a bad guy. And I don't know why you care about him. He's not even the president.
I don't know why people care about Joe Biden either, being the president, and that is basically the point of this episode, I guess, is what to do when you have an incredibly unlikable person running for president against an even more unlikable person who also used to be the president. And I think it's true, Matt, the worst part of an election year is that everyone is compelled to say what they think about voting, and I guess we are leaning into it by being compelled to say something about it here. But the real occasion is the State of the Union address happened, and it is, as always, kind of a, I don't know, the weird, like, the most boring version of the Super Bowl for liberals, I guess, where everybody gets excited about Joe Biden and just, like, takes him at his word for some reason at every turn. And even though, a handful of liberals were, like, they, like, suddenly learned how to do fact checks during Trump's presidency and were obsessed with, like, scrutinizing every single claim made by the White House. Everybody has forgotten how to do that. It's a big cheerleading night. And the State of the Union this time, I think, had some pretty interesting interesting comments from the president seeking re-election, and also framed things in some ways that are very revealing. And I think, I don't know, it didn't really change my opinion about voting in general and all the weird kind of dumb calculuses that people make when they think about voting. But it is interesting to kind of have this similar conversation 4 years later, with also the benefit of being able to look back retrospectively at what Biden has done as the president. And maybe we'll kind of figure out, I don't know, if that changes any hues from what we talked about 4 years ago. I didn't listen to our last podcast and probably never will. So who knows? We could also say something different and I wouldn't even know about it. But we'll see.
I remember that podcast like it was just yesterday. And boy, has time flown. That sounds like a good plan. It's important in a few different ways to kind of get this figured out, because I think, well, I'll say what I think right up front here, I guess, is that, like, the trap of electoral politics is thinking that it's really, really important. And I think that that's just not really the case. In a big, dumb capitalist sort of world that we live in right here, it's just like not the most important thing going on. Organizing is the most important thing going on. That's it. So I think that's something like what we said last time, probably, that we get too wrapped up in the big spectacle of it all. Let's talk about the spectacle of it all for a few minutes. The State of the Union, it was just really recently, and I didn't watch it, first of all. I'll say that too. I've read the coverage after the fact, and I feel like that's close enough. That's as close as I want to get to it, maybe. The State of the Union is such like a profoundly upsetting thing to watch or listen to. It's not honest in a way that is meaningful. You know, it's not like Joe Biden's going to tell the truth about something, or he'll tell the truth in a really selective way that makes him look very cool, because it's really just a big public relations exercise that Joe Biden can give himself a lot of snappy talking points, and then they can, you know, cut it together with big standing ovations of other Democrats or whatever. Or like score points against Republicans. I guess it's just like frustrating to even like really engage with the State of the Union in a really open way, because it feels just like I'm being gaslit. I remember watching it the last time around, and it's like you're hearing somebody talk about the world in a way that is not reflective of the world that I actually live in, which I think is bizarre. You know, it's somebody telling you how great things are, and then, you know, you know the facts about the world, about how labor laws are broken, the number of like poor people is growing. It's just like a whole other world that I don't actually live in, and it feels profoundly strange to even listen to, so I don't really like to. But we've read some of the coverage of it. We have some of the talking points. I think it's maybe just an interesting thing to see like what kind of world Joe Biden thinks that we do live in, sort of this weird parallel reality that exists over here. So, I came up with a handful of high points that we could talk about, Dean, and, we can just go through them really quickly. This is more of a bit than anything, maybe.
I also should say I'm the same way. I can't watch the State of the Union live because, I don't know, I'm just not mature enough to handle how mad it makes me and feel good about that. So I have to, like, keep it at an arm's length. But I did log on to Twitter while it was happening just to get some live reacts. And I think that is also interesting, too. Like, on the one hand, you're getting the world that Biden thinks that we live in. And then you're also kind of finding out, I guess, who suddenly feels impassioned by that vision and confirmed and so on. And then, like, you know, who doesn't. So I think it'd be interesting to talk about that maybe at the end as well, because I don't know, like going into an election year, everybody suddenly feels, as I said before, like they forget how to be critical. And I think the stakes feel so high that people also get nervous about criticisms being made. And I won't name a ton of names, but it was interesting to watch like some more liberal Christians who had given themselves permission to become a little bit more progressive over the last few years and maybe more critical of Biden, who suddenly also found themselves singing his praises uncritically as they were excited about this old man finding energy. I guess that's the big story of the State of the Union, is that Joe Biden showed that he can yell into a microphone and not fall asleep. So anyway, we can talk maybe about that piece as well. Some of the weird internet discourse around it.
We could probably flag too at the very top here that Joe Biden did use the phrase illegal to reference a person who is undocumented, and I think that does suck. This is not actually in the show notes. I'm just kind of saying it because I forgot to put it in the show notes maybe, but you know, people were upset because the phrase illegal has been struck from the Democratic vocabulary since Bill Clinton, which is true, but also such a funny idea in the first place that there is like a Democratic vocabulary. I mean, there certainly is. It's just like just all too gross and stupid and like disingenuous. A very society of the spectacle kind of way to think about the world that is accurate.
Oh man, speaking of a society of the spectacle, this is like some great Guy Debord inspired like anarchist graduate student needs to get out there and make like the Democrat field guide to American politics, just like a really neat detournement or something. I feel like you could have a lot of fun creating that resource. Maybe that's the way to disrupt the election this year. Just create some fake manuals of how the Democrats speak and think about the world.
Dang, that's a great idea. A free idea for somebody. All right, so the actual State of the Union, it had, you know, a handful of things. Joe Biden, he was saying all kinds of stuff. He was getting claps, he was getting jeers. That's all great. We love it. But there's a few important parts that we can maybe pull out that are sort of interesting, especially as they kind of pertain to topics that we've discussed on the podcast before. So the first thing is COVID. The second thing is inflation. And then there's a third secret thing called the Unity Agenda, which I think is really stupid and worth talking about. On COVID, what you get from Joe Biden is a lot of magical thinking, and I think that's deeply frustrating. I don't like that at all. This is from an NPR article called Biden's State of the Union Recap, and this is what it says about Joe Biden and COVID. Biden called for people to get vaccinated, for children to get vaccinated, and for production and distribution of antiviral pills to protect vulnerable people. He also forcefully called for the country to get back to work and to fill our downtowns and to keep schools open. Okay. I don't know. I don't know exactly what that's referenced to. I guess, like, you know, people are still working from home or something. I don't know exactly what this is about, but I feel like the downtowns are probably full enough. Biden said, "I cannot promise a new variant won't come, but I can promise you we will do everything within our power to be ready if it does." And I hate that so much because it's just not true. In no way is it true. The CDC has just recently released all kinds of new guidance on whether or not you can leave your house and kind of go spread COVID willy-nilly if you have it. And I guess it sucks that this is just like such a blatant lie. There's no way that if there was a new awful deadly variant that was extremely contagious and everyone suddenly had it, like it was 2020 all over again, Joe Biden would not be ready. No one would be ready. It would just be all awful again. It's so frustrating to hear this.
Yeah, it's also, it's the absence of all the lessons that people should have learned from COVID. I was talking with someone just recently, a friend of mine, who is like a basically normal person, which is to say not obsessed with thinking about politics and religion and whatever else. And he was saying, you know, the weird thing about the pandemic is that it really revealed what is possible if people actually want to do certain things. And he was referring in particular to like the stimulus checks mm-hmm. in the US and then the child care tax credit and the CERB in Canada, which was basically like a short-lived kind of UBI experiment. All these kind of moments where even, you know, very like austerity-pilled governments like Canada and the US were willing to basically just kind of give people money for a second. And on like lots of other things too, right? Like unemployment went so low right after the pandemic that like the Federal Bank had to engineer like inflation crisis in order to like get people fired from their jobs, which we can talk about in a minute. But all that to say, like all these things that sort of, you know, every economic crisis puts into relief, that inequality is real and also it could be addressed if there was a will to do it, that there is no actual like magic rule of economics that says governments can't help populations. All these kinds of things are just like things that I guess the Biden administration is disinterested in. You know, it's like the kind of thing where you could really seize on that if you were a politician with vision and be like, we're going to build a society that like takes for granted that these kinds of things we did in a moment of exception actually could be normative and that would be great. But instead you get this like appeal to, I don't know, fill your downtowns
yeah.
and to be like, we'll be ready when there's a variant, don't worry. But not apparently by supporting anybody with kids and so on. So just a bizarre kind of way to kind of, I guess, package the lessons of COVID.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I mean, the child tax credit is a thing that sticks out to me as being such a great example of just that, like what you could accomplish if you had the political will to do it or something. Maybe it sticks out to me because I was a person with a child and was benefiting from it. But in case you don't remember or it flew under the radar for you, that's fine. But in 2021, the federal government enacted an expansion of the child tax credit, which I think does exist in some different ways right now still, but is fundamentally different than it was. But basically, it gave all kinds of money to people with parents, or people with parents, well, no, people with kids. But it ultimately led to this like huge decline in the U.S. child poverty rate, according to PBS News, a great reputable news site, I guess. It led to a 46% decline in the U.S. child poverty rate. So pretty significant. Like if you are a person that yeah. doesn't like child poverty, this thing is for you. And then the child tax credit ended in 2022 and people fought really hard, maybe not hard enough even, but they fought to have it extended and they didn't. And surprise, in 2022, the child poverty rate in the United States went up drastically in, I don't know. It, like, people, journalists have tracked it and stopped tracking it, but, like, I remember reading something. Hang on. I'll say what it says in this article, actually. How about that?
Yeah.
In 2022, after the child tax credit ended, the child poverty rate in the U.S. skyrocketed 12.4%. So it's just like all that great stuff was undone, basically, in a year when they just stopped caring. Anyways, all that to say, it's a great observation about what can happen if the government is pressed to do something. You know, now they don't care anymore. And exactly like you said, get back to work, go back, fill up downtown, keep your schools open, keep your grades up, and then don't worry about it. We got it covered. I don't know. It's just a whole nother world. Joe Biden does not. Like, I guess, like, okay, hang on. Let me say this before we even get too much further. Is the time that I have kind of worked in campaigning, I've learned that politicians are, like, fundamentally people who have not talked to normal people in a long time, and, like, that's a pretty big deal. Like, I don't know. Anyone who is, like, your state senator, maybe they've talked to normal people, maybe not. I would guess they haven't. But people in the federal government, for sure, definitely not Joe Biden. Like, when was the last time Joe Biden has talked to a person who was, like, a real person who, like, works a real job in any capacity? It's probably been a very long time. He doesn't know what's happening in people's lives. And, I mean, I'm sure that you're like, federal U.S. Congress people haven't either. All of that to say, like, you should tell them. You should tell them what you think of them and what you're going through. Maybe they'll listen, maybe not. But frustrating all the same.
Yeah, no kidding. It's weird, too, just because I think it's strange to identify COVID as a thing in the State of the Union address. But then, kind of like you're saying, sort of ignore the reality of what it is. I mean, I do think that there's kind of a weird discourse around COVID in general. Like, nobody really knows how serious it is anymore or how to take it seriously. You never really know when to wear a mask or not, all that kind of stuff. But it is wild that the White House has essentially just decided it's, like, not interesting, but, like, you do have to have a little asterisk in there to, like, point out that you've heard of it and you're, like, proud of how you got through it. I don't know, just kind of a weird like, appendix to have as, like, the leader of the most powerful country in the world.
That's a great point. I mean, remember in 2020 and 2021, like, that was, like, literally the only thing people ever talked about ever. Even if you didn't really know somebody and you'd talk to them, they'd be, it's just like, wow, how's COVID been for you guys, you know? And now it's just like now it's like a small footnote in the State of the Union rather than the entire focus. Okay. Moving right along here, another footnote that Joe Biden's not that interested in talking about, or he is, but more magical thinking, is inflation. People really started talking about inflation, I think, especially around COVID because of the, like, economic fallout from it and after it. I'm going to read this bit from NPR here, and then we can talk about inflation and what Joe Biden has in mind. I don't know. It's bizarre. So the NPR article says, Biden laid out a kitchen sink approach to inflation. He's that's great. He said he authorized releasing oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Oh my God. He spoke about price gouging and he called for the confirmation of his Federal Reserve Board nominees. He also took a nationalistic turn promoting making products in America. More magical thinking. And then he said, there's a quote here from Joe Biden, lower your costs, not your wages. He urged companies, make more cars and semiconductors in America. More infrastructure and innovation in America, more goods moving faster and cheaper in America, more jobs where you can earn a living in America instead of relying on foreign supply chains. Let's make it in America. I think this is bonkers for so many reasons. I mean, it's not bonkers. I mean, Joe Biden is saying things that he knows that people will like to hear, for sure, right? People are always saying this kind of thing. Not the lower costs, not wages. I think that's probably still outside normal conversations that people usually have. But the make things in America is such a conversation that you'd hear if you went to, like, a family reunion to talk to your uncles or aunts about something. Why aren't things made in America anymore is a question they might ask. And it's funny that Joe Biden is just like, we should just make things in America, completely, like, ignoring the economic reality of the world and why things are not made in America and, like, fundamentally unwilling to confront that reality, but just kind of, like, asserting it. And maybe if he says it with just enough riz, it'll actually happen. I don't know. It's such a bizarre thing to say.
I mean, the funniest thing in the world is being like, lower your costs, not your wages, and also don't rely on foreign supply chains. Like, I don't know what you want, man. Like, that's not how it works.
Yeah, it is very funny. Because, like, on the one hand, there's something kind of true about lower your costs, not your wages. Like, that is a real recommendation that a government could make to a big corporation. But, like, a government would have to make them do it, you know, like it's, if you wanted that to happen, it would be probably a good thing. It would mean marginally less profits for a big corporation and the same wages for workers, which is not ideal. They probably should get more wages if anything, but like still, if Joe Biden, the literal president of the United States, wanted to make that happen, he could probably do it through legislation and other means. So just like, I don't know. It's frustrating. He's just saying things. He's just saying things out loud to say them, and I don't like it.
Yeah, and I mean, it's like, whatever. The president, it doesn't have, like, absolute and total power, or can't, like, remake the economic world by fiat, but also, like...
The president couldn't, but Dark Brandon could.
Yeah, for sure. But it's just weird to be, like... I don't know, the biggest tool that Biden has in his toolbox is to kind of, like, plead with companies to be, I don't know, like, more responsible, or, like, speaking out against price gouging is extremely funny. Like, that's the kind of thing that a president can definitely intervene in and just, I don't know, doesn't.
Yeah.
Like, having, like, a big finger and wagging it is the kind of thing that, you know, companies deal with all the time. Like, they are not intimidated by it, and it's like, fine. I don't know. It's weird too, because, like, you could legislate certain things. You know, there's even talk around grocery inflation and how bizarre that is and how nuts it is. And especially here in Canada, there's been a huge discourse around it. And the idea that governments just kind of have to, like, accept that companies do whatever they want, especially with extremely basic things like food or other goods, is really strange. And it's just like weird to get in front of every lawmaker in a country and just say that and expect it to kind of go over well, and everybody, you know, applauds it and is like, yeah, that makes sense. I don't know, people shouldn't price gouge. I guess there's nothing else we can
right.
do. It's just a really nihilistic kind of thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, there's one more piece here from the State of the Union that's maybe is it worth talking about? I don't know, but it is funny and interesting that again, it's evidence of the Joe Biden lives in another world kind of situation. So there's this thing that Joe Biden talks about in the State of the Union called the Unity Agenda. This is the context that the NPR article gives, and I think it's helpful but stupid for all the reasons that the people that listen to this podcast already know. And the NPR article says, Biden certainly tried to seek out a middle path that focused on what he called a unity agenda with four parts: beating the opioid epidemic, taking on mental health, supporting veterans, and ending cancer as we know it. And then beyond that, just look at how he talked about the police throughout his campaign. Biden broke from liberals in his party and called for more funding for the police. He emphasized that again on Tuesday night during the State of the Union. He said, let's not abandon our streets or choose between safety and equal justice, Biden said, adding that we should all agree the answer is not to defund the police. The answer is to fund the police, fund them with the resources and training they need to protect the communities. Okay, there's a lot going on with this approach that we can talk about maybe in a minute, but I would love to focus in for 1 second about this whole thing about police at the end. First of all, this is stupid. Second of all, the premise is, let's not abandon our streets. And it's like, who are we abandoning them to, Joe Biden? Like, I would love to hear the end of that sentence. Like who is it that the streets are being abandoned to? Man, so frustrating. Anyways, Dean, what do you think about the Unity Agenda? Are you unified behind this?
Well, yeah, you know, Biden said we should all agree, and that was enough for me. Now, all of a sudden, I think we shouldn't defund the police. We should just all agree. It's as simple as that. It is very funny to me. One thing I would like to hear more about is ending cancer as we know it. I feel like that's an extremely funny qualification. What other kinds of cancers are we kind of willing to live with? Just a really weird kind of addendum rhetorically.
You know, there's a great country with a really interesting healthcare system that has done a lot to end cancer as people know it. It's called Cuba.
Yeah, that's right. The real Unity Agenda. That's what we need. Yeah, I mean, it is wild because even the idea of kind of talking about unity always begs the question of unity for whom and at whose expense, you know? And, like, every single one of these points is basically a talking point related to Republicans, right? And, like, some of them are like, they're all fine. I mean, who doesn't like beating the opioid epidemic or dealing with mental health, supporting veterans, ending cancer? Like, these are all boilerplate things, I guess, and that's fine. Like, we should do all those things. But they're all those things, I think, are also interesting points because, like, they all stem from basically rural and Republican concerns, which, again, are fine to have. Like, I am from a rural Republican community, and I actually think those are real issues in those communities, and Democrats should talk about them. But the other pieces of unity that are not present are pretty interesting. You know, like, I don't know, like, ending racial injustice, I guess, is not, like, part of a unity agenda. You know, it's like, who is kind of being invited in here and who is basically just being assumed to already be in the coalition? And this is the standard move the Democrats make. They constantly try to appeal to an imaginary center or the right, and then basically chastise the left for abandoning them. And it's the kind of thing that you're going to hear over and over again until November, that the Democrats are going to be like wheeling out these pieces of rhetoric that try to find the Never Trumpers and kind of pull them into the Democratic coalition, and then complain about the fact that people on the left are upset about that precise move. And I think it's important as an electoral observer and participant to sort of, I don't know, gauge, like, what exactly is it that you're being asked to give up or sacrifice in order to come along. And if that's the unity agenda, like I said, those are all fine enough things to do. I mean, apart from the police bit, but, you know, these other kinds of priorities that social movements have demanded during the Trump years, especially, and then going into the Biden years, are just, I don't know, kind of being slotted off.
Yeah, it's true. Something important about the State of the Union too, and like these particular agenda items that we're hearing about, is like these are the things that the Democrats think are important for the upcoming election, and these are like the parameters for conversations around maybe policy and other issues. So it is not like these things were chosen on accident. These are the goalposts, I guess, on either side of the field for like what the Democrats are willing to take on, and it's not what you'd want them to be, for sure, as a person on the left.
The very simple piece even about being like, we don't have to choose between safety and equal justice, and the answer is to fund the police, is already a signal, right, that, like, you know, the social movements that the Democrats are going to complain about are precisely the movements the Democrats are also actively arguing against. So I don't know, it's like a weird kind of thing to be really mad that all of a sudden the left is abandoning you, when also from the State of the Union, the president is being like, I'm literally not going to deal with what you're telling me to
do. Exactly. That's the State of the Union. There's more to it, obviously. There's it's a big speech. There's more than what we've given here. Don't think this is exhaustive, but I guess these were like some of the high points that I read in a lot of coverage and I thought were worth talking about. Something that you might notice is missing from the State of the Union, and what is probably like the biggest demand from the left right now currently, is a ceasefire in Palestine. And that's pretty striking. Dean, what do you make of that? Something that's sort of missing from the conversation.
I mean, he did mention it obliquely in the State of the Union address, but definitely oblique. And, you know, in such a way that it's all, again, pretty boilerplate stuff, or like doublespeak, or things that are outright lies. And I think the important part of it around that is right before the State of the Union, as listeners of the podcast will know, hundreds of thousands of people across the U.S. Were launching uncommitted votes in the Democratic primary. So trying to signal, I guess, that they're not committed to voting for Joe Biden. And that, I don't know, it's not like all those people are polled, but there's a lot of organizing around it related to Biden's support for the genocide in Gaza in particular. And that narrative has also carried on past the State of the Union. I feel like all the things that were talked about in the address, I've seen kind of fade into the background. Like, nobody's going on to talk about Biden's unity agenda. They're not talking about his thoughts on inflation and so on. But they are talking about his stance on Israel. Like, that is kind of the issue that's continuing. And Biden even had to, you know, fight through a crowd, essentially, of protesters outside of Congress who were protesting his stance on Gaza. So it's like the issue that is in the air. I mean, the one kind of thing that is determining, I think, the his loss of support at this stage, at least the biggest issue, And I mean, it's been pretty wild to see Biden constantly try to like minimize that electoral threat and then also be upset with people for telling him that like maybe it's actually not a minimal thing and it could be a huge liability that, you know, he's willing to like throw the election away on, you know, genocide in particular. So I don't know. I feel like if anything, this is going to be probably the nail in the coffin for the Biden campaign. And it doesn't seem like they are interested in kind of turning it around. And to be honest, I don't even know how they could. Like the sunk cost into it is so right. huge that like at this stage, they literally could not admit that it's bad. At least like, you know, Biden will say it's bad that all these Palestinians are dead and he'll like criticize Netanyahu and so on. But like they could never admit that they made a mistake by like not intervening or not using their, you know, diplomatic and material powers to soften that ahead of it. So I don't know. I don't know how they're going to get out of this one, but I think that's the lasting piece of discourse, kind of even overshadowing all the propaganda from the State of the Union.
Yeah. Framing it as a big sunk cost is maybe a great way to think about it. Like, you know, what could the Democrats do at this point to turn it around? Probably not much. You know, in the UK, this is not an analogous situation at all, but it is not completely dissimilar either. The Labour Party, you might have heard of them. They're like the gross centrist party of the UK. They've not always been that way, but they are right now for sure. And anyways, they were forced to vote for a ceasefire 2 times in Parliament. And the first time, Keir Starmer, the big boss of the Labour Party, told everybody in the Labour Party not to vote for it or they're going to get kicked out. And some people did get kicked out. Anyways, and then they got a second chance to vote for it, where they dodged the actual, I'm trying to like pass over all the weird niche UK politics stuff here, but they dodged the initial call for a ceasefire that was made from another party that they don't like called the Scottish National Party. And they proposed their own call for a ceasefire that didn't really like mention Israel as like the primary aggressor and didn't really mention that they were like punishing the population of Palestine. And then they all voted for it. But even though they passed it, all of the members of Parliament and Labour were trying to kind of play this off like it was a big moral victory from them, even though they previously didn't vote for it. But like everybody on Twitter that I saw, at least, and like lots of explanations from the press were just like, and they're stupid for this. Like, this is like, everyone clearly knows the Labour Party is dumb and they just are like kind of trying to save face and they are failing to do so, right? So anyways, even the about face on the situation didn't really win them any points in the end.
Yeah, like he is calling for a 6-week ceasefire.
That's right.
And
yeah,
from what I can understand too, the intention is that during that 6 weeks they would also try to negotiate toward a more permanent solution. But you know, it's what the frustrating bit is, like, so Biden gave this interview, I think it was an MSNBC interview, like right around the State of the Union, and they talked about all kinds of stuff, including the uncommitted voters and the ceasefire and Gaza and all this kind of stuff. And the thing that really stuck out to me is that the interviewer directly asks him, is there a red line with Netanyahu or kind of what would the red line be? And Biden literally says, there's no red line where I'm going to cut off their weapons and so on. And I think that is absolutely bizarre. Like, there is literally nothing that Netanyahu could do that would stop the flow of arms to Israel. And it's like, you know, if you really want to see a 6-week ceasefire, you should probably not give them weapons right. to keep, you know, killing people. Like, that's the simplest bit. Or like, you know, on the aid piece too. So the U.S. is doing these airdrops now, some of which have actually killed Palestinians, which is insane, because these, you know, big sacks of flour are like falling out of the sky like a ton of bricks. And then also the U.S. has this like really weird idea to build like a floating platform within 60 days off the coast of Gaza and then deliver aid by ships or, you know, all this kind of weird stuff. And you have to imagine there's also lots of other kind of ulterior motives involved in such a project. But the wild thing is, like, it is not the U.S.'s responsibility to deliver aid to Gaza. It's Israel's responsibility by international law to allow aid into Gaza unrestricted. And the U.S. is just, like, not making them do that. Like, they're literally just, like, I don't know, like, giving their own aid in such a way that it continues to run cover for Israel avoiding its own responsibility. So, I don't know, I'm ranting at the stage, but it drives me crazy because it's, like, you know, Biden and people who support Biden will constantly point to the fact that he will say he supports a ceasefire, that he will say he's critical of Netanyahu and so on. But, you know, all of those words are literally meaningless when they are actively supplying them with weapons. When every time there's a vote in the UN Security Council, the U.S. uses its veto to ignore any kind of issues that would really impinge on Israel, all these kinds of things. So, you know, I think as long as even that remains the, like, policy of Biden, it's pretty hard to imagine, like, even the like, glimmer of doing an about face. Like, at this stage, you know, Biden literally couldn't back down. Like, it would be the admission of supporting genocide, which he definitely can't do. Well, literally can't do.
Not so, an election year.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like, yeah, it's like a really big bet to be like, I bet I can win over these hundreds of thousands of uncommitted voters and still also do this extremely bad
totally.
Thing.
I mean, it demonstrates just how hollow the call for a ceasefire is if, like, if there is no red line, if there's nothing that Israel can do that will make Joe Biden stop, like, supporting the genocide, then, like, what good is a negotiation, right? Like, if you have literally no bottom to the negotiation, I guess, like, who really cares? I don't know. It seems disingenuous, to say the very least. But anyways, a good rant. I'm here for it.
I mean, it's just the standard kind of liberal way of doing politics that is not unique to Biden, but he embodies it in a pretty bald kind of way. But you get the same thing in Canada and every other kind of liberal government around this, which is to say, the idea is, it's basically the same as Biden's approach to dealing with companies doing price gouging, right? It's like, he has the power to do something, but instead he's sort of wielding this strange sense of, like, rhetorical authority that doesn't really exist. And there's this, like, it's magic words kinds of politics, you know? If you say it from the position of being the president or the prime minister or whatever, there's this assumed efficacy, but there's no material follow-up to it. And I mean, it's like worse than assuming that, you know, some people in the Christian world, they'll be like, I hope that the Pope says this or that thing about a global situation and that will really turn the tide. Which, like, I hope the Pope says things that are right about situations of injustice as well. But at the end of the day, it's just kind of like a moral authority saying something. You know, like, the Pope has no material influence on many kinds of situations. But it's like the weirder situation when a president feels they also have basically the same kind of role, like the moral authority role, except they do have material powers available to them that would make a difference. So it's just the constant sort of trading of, you know, or like backing down from real power in the interest of, like, the empty rhetoric of words that I guess they think exculpates them or, like, excuses them from having to do anything. But again, it's going to be from now till November, liberals basically being like, Biden says he doesn't like what's going on, and that should be enough for everybody else.
Right. And it's important to say that it's not enough for everybody else because it's nothing. Because there's not much of a difference between, you know, wishing that corporations would just stop price gouging and, you know, wanting a ceasefire but fundamentally doing nothing for it. It's bad and hollow and completely awful. I don't know. That's nothing. It's just nothing, I guess I'm trying to say here.
Well, let's talk about the uncommitted vote, because I think that's been an interesting kind of response to the nothingness of all that rhetoric.
Yeah, I agree. It's an interesting response in a few different ways. I think, okay, let's talk about the uncommitted vote first, and then we can talk about maybe what it means activist-y wise or whatever. So you might have heard it, maybe you haven't, but Super Tuesday happened shortly after the State of the Union, and also some states were having primaries before the State of the Union. It's complicated, and I can't say that I know all of the dates for these things, but that's okay. But this big push for voting uncommitted in primaries really kicked off in Michigan, where 101,000 Michigan residents cast uncommitted ballots in the Democratic primary. And that was like 13% of voters in Michigan said, you know, I'm not committed to Joe Biden as the president-elect for the Democratic Party. And then on Super Tuesday, a bunch of other states went to go vote in their primaries as well. And a bunch of other states also kind of pulled this uncommitted or no preference category as like a sort of concerted effort to tell Joe Biden, like, stop, you're awful. And some interesting results, I think. In Minnesota, that was probably the place that pulled off the highest percent of uncommitted votes, with 19% of primary votes going to uncommitted, which I think is a pretty big deal, honestly. 19%, mm-hmm. It's great. Other states did it as well with, like, I think less big numbers. But I think given the amount of time I think people had to actually organize these big pushes, it's pretty significant. Like North Carolina, a mm-hmm. state that is, you know, deeply red, but has a big, I think, activist history with regards to, I mean, labor for sure and other things too. But North Carolina had 12.7% of voters voting. I think no preference was that state. And then Massachusetts as well has a no preference category, and they came in around 9.3%. So anyways, an interesting, like, kind of like last minute organized effort from people who care about the genocide and the United States' role in it to, like, come out and have an interesting say in it. I don't know, Dean, what's your take as a person not in those states, but watching?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been pretty remarkable. I feel like it's a really brilliant strategy, because at the end of the day, the Democrats only care about electoral signals. I mean, sometimes they're bad at reading those too, but they don't really care about people showing up, and they don't care about big rallies. They don't care about huge protests. You know, people have been in the streets for Palestine since October, and it's been hundreds of thousands of people weekend after weekend, especially in major urban areas. And at the end of the day, like, obviously the White House just doesn't feel pressured by that. They don't feel compelled to do anything. And the one thing that can compel that kind of liberal brain disease, I think, is an electoral threat, you know, the idea that voters won't come. And the only way that Biden beat Trump in the last election was by a pretty diverse coalition that included a lot of first-time voters, myself included. I never voted in an election until that one, not because I liked Biden, but because I really didn't like Donald Trump, and felt that that would, you know, is a difference that still made a difference despite all that. We'll talk about that more maybe at the very end of this episode. But all that to say, you know, it was a really fragile kind of group of folks, and who knows what will happen between Biden and Trump this year. But if it requires such a fragile coalition, like, Biden is going to lose a ton of those voters for sure. And I think it's pretty brilliant to be like, what's a signal that would get the party's attention that this is an issue that matters for, you know, potential voters, and it's to vote in an uncommitted way. So I saw, like, after the Michigan vote, I read this article somewhere where a Democratic strategist was like, well, you know, 13%, like, that's not too scary. Like, we could maybe pull those around or figure it out. And it's unsurprising in Michigan because there's such a huge Arab population. So they're kind of writing it off. And this person was like, when it gets around 20%, then I'd probably be concerned. And this person was saying it as though that was absurd. But Minnesota got pretty close. I mean, 19% is right around it. So, you know, I think it's a huge kudos to the organizers being able to pull that off with such short notice. It's a good tactic.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's with short notice as well, right? Like, if this was a campaign with a bit longer runway, I think it could have been a lot bigger. And, you know, I mean, there is just such a big long runway up until the next election that it could be bigger. So I think it's worth considering how big of a deal it could be. Given, I don't know, how people are feeling, I think, once the dust settles on some of this, some more. But it's worth thinking about. Yeah. You know, I think, though, you mentioned a minute ago that, like, in the last election, when Joe Biden was elected, that there was a pretty big tent of people who got him elected. And that is something to actually consider. I was part of that big tent of people. I sent texts for Joe Biden, unfortunately. I'm sad to admit on this podcast. you know, and so did other people. Like, rank and file union people were even doing that work. And I think that there's been a lot of, like, a lot of shift, though, from that big coalition of people who did get Joe Biden elected in the first place. I remember, like, you know, did a lot of sort of volunteer work to get, like, sending texts and all that kind of garbage, but, like, more, like, regular, like, low wage workers were kind of joining in some of that volunteer work. And after Joe Biden got elected and it was really clear that, you know, we wouldn't see things like higher minimum wages or other changes to labor law, they felt pretty devastatingly betrayed. And I feel like that's something that's just like underestimated by Democrats. It's just like that big tent got him elected in the first place. And if he's not going to listen to that big tent again, then I think there's going to be a problem. And I guess they don't care, or they think that it'll shake out in a different way. But I don't know. I would think twice about how pissed off people are at him in particular for not sort of delivering on a lot of things. Student debt, minimum wages, but also like genocide. Bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's tough because, so like I said, last time around I voted for him, and I'll be transparent, like I'm gonna send in my my absentee ballot with an incredibly sad bubble for Joe Biden back to Michigan, and like they'll never open it, but you know, they'll have it if they need it or whatever. And that is a choice that I'm gonna make. But and like, I should be clear too, I actually do think that like Biden and Trump are not the same. I think they're both bad? Absolutely. But like, you know, these are not like choices that make zero difference, especially in a number of issues. And it is like a choice between two bad options. But I don't know, I've watched enough reality TV to know that like sometimes choosing between two bad options really makes a difference for whether or not you win $500,000 at the end. You know, it's just like these kinds of choices matter in a marginal way. So I don't know, that's one of my like weird hot leftist takes, is that I don't think voting is meaningless. But on the other hand, I also don't think voting is like the most important thing. And that's going to be the key between now and November, is liberals trying to convince people that voting is the most important thing you could possibly do. It's the ultimate expression of political will. It's like the key to expressing that you don't like Donald Trump and that you do want some alternative. And what's frustrating is in that rhetoric, I mean, it's the same thing that they've done the last couple of elections, but they're doing it again. They'll also try really hard to shame people for not voting, and they're doing it even with the uncommitted voters, to be like, how can you possibly, you know, allow Trump to be elected or to not kind of get behind Joe Biden? And what's so frustrating is like these folks who spend so much time trying to get people to vote for Joe Biden are also like just refusing to do the hard work you'd have to do, the introspective work to figure out how to actually get a Democrat elected, which is like, you know, that feeling of betrayal that you mentioned, that's the kind of thing that's going to keep a lot of people home. And like, those people are not going to be persuaded by like some weird liberal on the internet being like, I don't know, like having some strange scolding rhetoric about like how bad or dumb they are for like wanting to stay home. And at the end of the day, it's like all those kind of, you know, liberal influencer accounts, those are the folks that are going to further alienate Biden voters. And then in the event that Biden loses, we'll basically build a whole career off of being like, I told you so. Oh, you should have voted for Joe Biden, you know? And like, it's a vicious cycle, and it's too bad because things like the State of the Union are the perfect proof of like how that policy works. And to be honest, like, I will be genuinely surprised if Joe Biden wins this election, primarily because there's just like a deliberate denial of, you know, complicity in anything that's not going well in the United States, down to supporting genocide in Gaza.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's going to be a pretty tough one. I don't know. Happy to be wrong. I mean, I'm not an election wonk, and I don't have a huge stake in this either way. But I do think that Joe Biden's going to have a really hard time getting reelected. But I guess we'll see. You know, you're saying all that stuff about voting, and I think that makes a lot of sense to you. In the great democratic experiment that is my favorite reality TV show, Big Brother, people often say, you got to just do what's best for your game. And I think that's true even here. Is that, like,
that's right.
You know, is voting for Joe Biden the best thing that is? Is that what's best for your game? And it's like, well, probably it's the vote you should make, I guess. But it's like, you know, but there's so much more to the game of Big Brother and to the United States than voting for Joe Biden. You have to do other things, like win the power of veto. Like, you have to learn how to make really good alliances and talk to people. And I think these are transferable skills between Big Brother and the real world that we should all really be considering at this point.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if we don't, we'll be tuning in to watch that live eviction of Joe Biden from the White House.
Oh my God.
And you know, Donald Trump is the head of household is going to be bad news. That's just the way it is.
That's true. No one likes that. It's true. Yeah, it is really deeply frustrating though to think about how if Joe Biden does lose, and then like the cottage industry of shaming people on the left does get going, and it does launch 1,000 careers into people being on like MSNBC. Deeply upsetting idea, but it's what happened, you know, it's what happened in 2016, it's what happened in 2020 for different reasons, I guess, but it'll happen again, I'm sure, so just get ready for it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, people who are in the Discord will know this, and maybe some people who follow us on Twitter will know this, but for some reason, I don't know why, I've developed some incredibly perverse addiction to knowing what this one specific person, John Pavlovitz, has to say about politics. I don't know where this comes from, but he was like a megachurch pastor, and then he got fired from being a megachurch pastor, and then he was a youth pastor, and now he, as far as I can tell, is like a guy with a blog who also writes books and tweets about how great Joe Biden is. And I think, you know where it started from? Okay, this is some great, like, behind the scenes stuff that we've talked about in the Discord as well. Every once in a while, we post in the Discord a screenshot of, like, on this podcast, because it's a Christian podcast that talks about the left. We get these, like, solicitations from publicists of, like, weird, vaguely liberal authors to have them come on the show. And we always say no, because, listen, I don't want to talk to them. It sounds really boring. And also, I can't imagine our listeners want to listen to like some weird guy talk about his weird book about like why he's been a Democrat his whole life and also a pastor. Anyway, we got one email from the John Pavlovitz publicist a long time ago. And it was about this book he wrote. I can't even remember what it was. But in the email, they were like talking about how Chelsea Clinton endorsed the book. And like, that's like a great leftist bona fide. And like, he should be on the show. And we like usually just ignore the emails. But this person kept emailing us. And so eventually I replied to the email being like, this is a socialist podcast. We don't want to listen to Chelsea Clinton people. And anyway, all very goofy. And ever since that email, for whatever reason, I've also, like, the joke's on me. I mean, I have been deeply infected by this exchange. because every once in a while I just log on and I look up John Pavlovitz's Twitter, and I've become a John Pavlovitz reply guy. I never even tweet anymore. But I do just complain at this person in particular. And what drives me wild is like, he is the quintessential version of kind of the trajectory of how this liberal thinking about politics works. Like, this is a guy who thinks that he's like a very radical Christian guy because he was fired by a megachurch, I guess. And his whole shtick is like, we should like accept all people and love everybody and so on. But like every tweet that he makes is like just a parroting of like all these other Democratic accounts just complaining about conservatives or like insulting them on the internet, and then just shaming people on the left for not, I don't know, being extremely psyched about Joe Biden. And I don't know what got me on this tangent. I don't even know why I'm ranting about it now. I guess this is more of a confession than anything else. But this is like the example of the kind of person whose career is like made possible by just the extremely broken process of U.S. politics. And I think the key is to sort of resist the temptation to get sucked in. I'm maybe preaching to myself about it, but there's like a strange hamster wheel of discourse, and like once you're on it, it's hard to get off, where it just like pulls you along, the momentum like forces you to keep moving on it, of people like shaming people for not voting, and then people either being mad about that or endorsing it. And from now till November, I guess my advice is to just like make your choice, vote or don't vote, who really cares what you do, but just like forget about it, like refuse to be interested in the election. Nothing will possibly change between now and November that could, you know, presumably change your opinion one way or the other. And I think the key is to just think creatively about how to organize in the cracks, you know, like the Uncommitted campaign, such a great example of just like getting something going and having that kind of take root. So I think that's going to be the key, is like put your energy into that between now and November and just kind of see what happens.
Yeah, I like all of that. Make up your mind now, vote or don't vote. But the most important thing is that no matter who asks you, always say you're not going to vote. I think that's maybe also part of the key.
That's right.
Is that keep them guessing, zag on them, you know, just don't let them know that you really will vote. Make them work as hard as they possibly will for this vote if you're going to actually cast it. And if you're not going to cast it, then just tell the truth. It's fine. But if you are, hide under a bushel.
That's right. Yeah. Make your choice, but say you won't, I think is good. Because, I mean, it is true, though, because the, like we said earlier, the only thing that moves the needle in the Democratic Party is, like, the vague kind of prognostication or like astrology that they have to do to figure out whether or not they're going to have voters. And that's the key. I mean, it's also what's pushed Biden on a number of other issues over the course of his presidency. Like, you know, he was willing to basically, I think, give up the student debt thing entirely. And I mean, he did give up the sort of scope of what he had pitched and promised on the campaign trail. But people were so pissed that he was giving up completely that they did win marginal gains here and there. And I think that's the key, is to just like constantly be a person that like they're afraid to lose, because that's the only way that you're going to get anything.
There you go. I think that's good advice. You got to do what's best for your game, and your game is keep them guessing.
Thanks for listening to The Magnificast. If you like what you heard, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/TheMagnificast. If you support us at $2 or more, you can get into this Discord where we talk about all kinds of stuff and occasionally post screenshots of emails of weird liberals soliciting themselves as guests on the podcast. You know, one of these days, I guess we'll just have to say yes to one of them. And I don't know who it will be, but it could be one. So you can get in the Discord and pressure us to do it, and maybe it'll work. Our music is by Amari Armstrong, our outro is by The Illogical Spoon, and we'll see you next week.
I don't want to get up for church in the morning, church in the morning, souls alive. Heaven come to earth and there won't be no church. We'll meet down by the riverside. There we'll swim with all creation. Never get tired, never bored. Don't worry, someday there'll be no dam between us and our Lord. Jackson, you keep your hoods up. You keep your hoods up and you stay up late. Jackson, you keep your hoods up. Well, you keep your hoods up and you stay up late. Oh, don't mind a cold night, but we might mind if you leave too soon. So come on now, it's still early. Decide what else are you gonna do. As we kissed in the alley by the Michigan Theater, fall snow was glowing in the lights of the downtown. Saw a spark in your eyes, I just spoke it. Said we're gonna turn this whole place upside down.